From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Teich. Today on the program, how a life in the arts and a life of faith can coexist.
Buddhism suggests that everything in the world is related to everything else. There's no one special place you go off to for religious experience as opposed to the rest of it. There is no rest of it. It's all part of your life.
How theater can help people age more meaningfully. The Milwaukee Rep's Mark Clements talks about what drew him to the play Ragtime.
So I'm interested in works, whilst being entertaining and fun, you know, that can also add a few layers of us to us as a decent human being, make us think a little bit, broaden our horizons.
And a writer explores the early history of the first kids' TV network, Nickelodeon. Lake Effect comes your way next, after the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich. Thank you so much for tuning in today. The tendency exists to think of people in narrowly defined terms: politicians, scientists, athletes, artists, people of faith. But the more you get to know people, the more you realize that we all live in different worlds, sometimes playing significant roles in more than one realm. Two Milwaukee people, leaders in the arts community, shifted their professional lives in past years and now are leaders in their faith communities. Tonin O'Connor was once Sarah O'Connor, the managing director of the Milwaukee Rep. She is now resident priest emerita of the Milwaukee Zen Center. Mohammed Issa Sadlin, formerly Christopher Goldsmith, retired from his position as executive director of the Milwaukee Art Museum some time ago and is now executive director, CEO emeritus of the Islamic Society of Milwaukee. The two will be featured speakers later this month at the first annual Faith Connections event held by the Interfaith Conference of Greater Milwaukee. But they join us first to talk about their stories. Welcome to both of you.
Great. It's great to be here.
Good to be here.
What led each of you to leave your previous professional careers in the arts world and pursue this life defined as much by faith as it is?
I didn't really leave my previous life to become involved with Buddhism. It began while I was still the managing director of the Milwaukee Repertory Theater. And I left the Rep when I retired at 65 and at that point became a full-time Zen teacher.
How did it happen to become part of your life while you were at the Milwaukee Rep?
Accidentally. The Rep, as you may remember, in the early 80s was touring to Japan a great deal. And I was going back and forth as a business person to set things up. And my friend at the other end learned I loved to travel. So on one occasion, when our business was done, we went and spent the night in a Zen temple. I was astonished, taken, didn't know anything about it, thought I should maybe find out something about it as a cultural matter, came back here, picked up a small book, and here I am today.
What was it that spoke to you so strongly at that point?
I would say that it was the atmosphere of sincerity. It was a private experience that I had that had to do with time and the fact that there was something powerful there that I was totally unfamiliar with. So I was curious.
Well, and I'm curious to hear more, but I would like to hear your story as well and how you went from the visual art world to this community of faith as you did.
Well, much like Tonin, this was a concurrent life. I served as executive director of the Milwaukee Art Museum since the early 1980s, and I was introduced to Islam through a Jewish friend who had become Muslim in the mid-1980s. And I was taken with it. I studied about it and actually decided to go through the conversion process in 1989. So I then stayed on at the Milwaukee Art Museum until 2002. So I had this very intense religious life, while I had an even more perhaps intense artistic life. Both of them operated side by side.
Did you find it difficult to exist so intensely in both worlds at the same time?
No, because Islam really emphasizes that we are of the world, that we should work and be involved with our communities and be active. So it was really compatible with the basic concepts of Islam. And I also found that if I organized my life properly, I could easily fit in the prayers, that I could fast during Ramadan, that all the things that were important to me that were I was able to do with the flexibility of the kind of position I had.
In much the same way, Buddhism suggests that everything in the world is related to everything else. There's no one special place you go off to for religious experience as opposed to the rest of it. There is no rest of it. It's all part of your life.
So that actually maybe shifts how I ask this next question, but I'm curious about the common threads that you see in both of those.
For me, the key is empathy, because Buddhism again suggests that our relationships to other beings, other activities, is the critical piece of our life. In the theater, we are constantly creating lives that we put on stage and hope people will feel empathy for. You know, experiences they may never have in their day-to-day life. So for me, it was a very natural transition, having spent many, many years attempting to both personally feel and get others to feel about other lives, to move into a religious faith that suggests that all lives ultimately are deeply connected.
What about the common threads between your life at the art museum and your life in Islam?
At the museum, my life was really totally devoted to my position. It wasn't a 9-to-5. It was something I thought about from the moment I woke up to the moment I went to bed. 7 days a week, I was involved with it on some level. As a practicing Muslim, our life is the same way. We organize our life by early morning prayer. We think about our purpose in life constantly throughout the day. Our practice of Islam is not a separate part of our life, but it's integrated into our worldview. So really, it was a museum worldview overlaid by an Islamic worldview, and the two were very compatible.
Do you view your museum worldview any differently now that you have this additional worldview to view it through?
No, because the museum worldview is one in which you work with the public, you work with the community, and you try to present them some options, some ways of looking at life. And a religious life is the exact same way. You're presenting some ideas, some concepts, some theology that can help people if, in fact, they operate in a certain way. So really, the two are kind of on a parallel track.
And do you feel you were able to view your artistic life differently once Buddhism became a part of it?
No, I don't think so. I think it was the other way, that the Buddhist understanding seemed to mesh with a lot of understandings I had built up over many years in the theater about how things can be. And one of the other great tenets of Buddhist teachings is clear seeing, you know, what's really going on here. Well, as a manager of a big theater company, that was often my question: what's really going on here? You know, not what you think or I think, but we need to know what's really going on here. So it was a very, very comfortable connection.
Do you see yourself in a leadership role differently, or I guess how do you compare being a leader in the arts world for both of you and being a leader of a faith community?
Well, I really approached the same way, and that's leadership as a servant, servant to your cause. It's not that you're the boss telling people mm-hmm. what to do. You're working with a group of people trying to really encourage them to see a common vision and then encouraging them to contribute in a way that's most useful and most valuable to themselves. That's really how you provide religious leadership also. It's not a top-down approach. It's a kind of an unveiling. It's a consensus building. It's trying to keep people in the same direction, providing encouragement and stepping in where there's problems and trying to clear those roadblocks. But you're really not being directive. You're really the mother duckling trying to herd everybody in the same direction and protect them from harm.
Is leading by example too oversimplified?
Well, leading by example is maybe step number one. Then you really have to be more outgoing, because you really have to encourage other people. It's not just that you do something that's done well, but you have to look at other people, their potential, how they can fit into the program, where they need some coaching, some encouragement. So you're really an enabler or an encourager. That's a real strong part of the role.
My limited understanding of Zen Buddhism leads me to believe that it is also not necessarily a top-down approach.
No, it is not. I think there are some traditions of Buddhism, which has many, many different traditions, where a leader might be considered a top-down sort of head of the thing. Within Soto Zen Buddhism, a teacher, a priest, is essentially a guide, somebody who's a little further along the path than you may be, but who, just as Issa has said, is encouraging, guiding, trying to help people develop their own understanding. You are not the boss at all.
You were both sharing your stories at this community event held by the Interfaith Conference. Is there a lesson in the trajectory of your life that you are hopeful that people in the audience will take with them?
Well, I think one lesson that I certainly learned myself is that, number one, anything is possible if you don't worry too much about your own ego, to worry too much about what the barriers are. But in fact, if you have a vision, you get people enthused about it, and you have a sense that we want to go in this direction, and you don't quite know exactly how you're going to get there or what it's going to look like in the end. If you're a control freak, it's a big problem. But if you're comfortable to let things go, you work, and things will unfold, that's the lesson I would like to share with people, that's a style that can produce great results.
Can you be an artist without a certain degree of ego? Some of it seems inherent in needing to assume people would want to see or experience what you have to offer as an artist.
I think there's a difference between an ego that says it's all about me and a very strong ego that says, I have something I want to share with others that I think is valuable. And I think that's an enormous difference and a very clear one.
And often many artists really don't care about the public at all. They're not really trying to project themselves or enforce their point of view. They just love to create. They just love to do their process. Mm-hmm. And if people like it or understand it, that's great. If they don't, that's not a problem. So in many, many artists' lives, the kind of traditional understanding of ego, I'm trying to push myself forward, just doesn't exist.
Is there a particular message you hope people will take from what you'll be talking about?
I would say to neither madly desire what we call success or be terrified by failure. Those are both just ideas. And that if we stick to what we need to do right now, we discover we do have the stuff to keep going over what may be a long continuum of time toward that vision that we and other people share. So that patience and a willingness to keep going, I think, are something can be helpful to people.
One of the interesting things is if anybody reads the Quran, the thing that you'll note is that the personal characteristic most required for success is called sabr in Arabic, patience, constancy, consistency, mm-hmm. never giving up. Without that, you really can't be successful because all of us have ups and downs. All of us have so-called failures. All of us have roadblocks. And the only way you're going to get around that is, in fact, with this patience or consistency.
Also, I think Buddhism teaches that there's no point in being, you know, too high up or too cast down about things. Those, again, are just our personal emotional reactions. So that if you can accept what's happening and then go from there, as opposed to being overwhelmed or in despair, you're really ahead. It suggests that we sometimes call it the middle path, but essentially equanimity is really a kind of state of mind that is urged by the Buddhist teachings.
Well, Tonin O'Connor, Mohammed Issa Sadlin, thank you so much.
Thank you. It was great
to
be here.
Thank you.
Mohammed Issa Sadlin is the former executive director of the Milwaukee Art Museum. He's now executive director, CEO emeritus of the Islamic Society of Milwaukee. Tonin O'Connor is the resident priest emerita of the Milwaukee Zen Center. She was formerly managing director of the Milwaukee Rep. The two will speak at next week's first annual Faith Connections event held by the Interfaith Conference of Greater Milwaukee. You'll find more information about it at wuwm.com/likeeffect. We'll take a quick break now, and then the Odyssey of a production of the Odyssey at a Milwaukee area nursing home. This is Like Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. Like Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Tyke. For a year, members of a theater company embedded themselves at Luther Manor Nursing Home in Wauwatosa and worked with the residents on a production called Finding Penelope, an adaptation from Homer's The Odyssey. Playwright Anne Basting and members of the Sojourn Theater Company took on the project to examine how the work might have a long-term positive effect on the residents of the center. It also spurred a documentary about the project called Penelope, produced by Milwaukee filmmaker Brad Lichtenstein. He and Anne Basting, who are also husband and wife, are in the studio with us to talk about both the play and the film. Nice to see you both.
Thanks. It's great to be here, as always.
Thanks, Mitch.
What got you thinking about how theater techniques might help people with Alzheimer's?
The answer to that question is about 15 years worth of work. Really, the realization very early on that when you go to a place of memory with a person with dementia and memory loss, you're likely to meet some shame and some failure. It's not necessarily going to go real well. Yet still, that's kind of the noble impulse that we have, is to go toward memory, to work with someone to reinvigorate their memories. Actually making a shift toward imagination really helps open a relationship to more equal, more responsive, more communicative, more an exchange of emotions. So that's the core of the work. Really, with this project in particular, we've been using those techniques of imagination for a long time, and we know that they work in small groups. The challenge here was to see if we could really infuse this approach across an entire care community. And Luther Manor is 1 million square feet. 700 people live there. 700 people work there on various shifts. It is a small village. And could we somehow use creativity and imagination to build a sense of connection and community in that place?
Was it difficult to get Luther Manor itself on board with this?
I'd had a long relationship with them, so I was very lucky. And I knew that if we could make it work somewhere, this was the place to make it work. I'd been working there probably for 15 years with some strong relationships that I'd built, particularly in the Adult Day Center with Beth Meyer Arnold, who's transformed that place. It's just incredible. So we had a solid relationship of trust to go on, yet still to approach someone and say, I have an idea. Let's read the Odyssey for a year with people, staff, family, residents across the entire care campus, and then create an original play and stage it site-specifically through the facility. Not your average person is going to say yes to that. So I'm really thankful that they opened themselves up to this experience.
Well, and how did this develop? I mean, it's one thing to put on a play, but it's another thing to do it in this site-specific way that I imagine was a challenge both to put on and for you, Brad, a challenge to capture.
Sure. The whole thing was a challenge to capture because we really didn't know where the project was going to go. And we originally thought that we would make a film or like a series of videos for an educational type of use. And then soon we discovered that it was really exciting dramatically because even though Anne had this long relationship with Luther Manor, the actual seeing and hearing the actors and the residents in a dining hall making a ton of noise as they rehearse a fight scene and disturbing people who have memory loss and how the staff is going to deal with that, all that sort of revealed to us there's all this drama. And as we all know, drama makes for good film. So we decided to try to do something a little bit more elaborate than just a video education module.
But how long did it take for you to figure out what this was, you know?
You know, the other part of this work is the other significant shift of this kind of an approach is that we're trying to create long-term care as a place of learning and growth, which the first thing when you think of long-term care, those are not the two operative words that come into mind. Can we create this as a place where we're really discovering and creating something with people there, not for people there, where that for puts them in a position of passivity. And with is collaboration, which means you don't know what's going to happen and you don't know who's going to come to the table. We spent Sojourn Theater, who is also involved with this project, integral involved in this project, collaborating with the students and Sojourn and everybody at the table, always inviting people to join us. So, from the first day we started to the last. And so it's evolving as it goes on. That was the course in the process.
I mean, what the film is really about is about how the actors, the theater group, the residents, they actually don't know what's going to happen. And one of the things that I think people have to understand about this, and they'll see it if they see the movie, is that it's not just about doing a community art project. The ambition to make really solid, high art out of this – I mean, it was funded by the Rockefeller Foundation, you know, serious high art – and make it inclusive and meaningful to all of the residents who are involved, including people with dementia, was the big challenge. And one of the things that you see in the footage and it's in the movie and it's also all over our outtakes is how frustrating that process is. There's a scene where Anne bangs her head literally against the speakerphone when she's in a conference call over what to do with a script. There's another scene where one of the younger people, the director of the play, discovers that the connections you make with people with dementia are not necessarily going to be there the next day.
And she talks about what a wonderful connection she made and then went back to the same person the next day and the person didn't remember a thing.
And one of the core questions is that okay? The beauty of that connection was pretty incredible. And we're left, I think, at the end with we made something beautiful in the moment. And how can it live on in maybe a different way rather than literal memory?
Well, I was going to say, and I think one of the things you see, too, is the transformation of the different people involved in this project. So you see the younger woman realizing that's okay if she doesn't remember me the next day. That's what this is all about. Or you also see the transformation in some of the older characters who are learning to perform a role and how that changes the way they see themselves and the way family and other people see them. It's pretty remarkable.
There, and it strikes me that there was another challenge that I think a staff member brought up, which was the transient nature of people who live in a place like this. The reluctance to take part in something like this when they might not be there tomorrow.
Yeah, that was a really profound fear that the staff there felt, which is, you know, what happens if you are casting somebody with the expectation that they'll be there in 3 months when the play is being put on and the very real possibility that they might die. That's kind of looming over the project all the time. There's actually outtakes we have. We didn't end up using it when an ambulance showed up to take somebody out during one of the rehearsals.
And something like that must really weigh on a group of professional performers. These are not the kinds of challenges that most theater companies are probably dealing with.
No, so Sojourn really is a unique leader in the whole country in this respect, really working very site-specifically and across sectors, bringing really unique partnerships to bear. But even this was a challenge for them because they had never performed in a space where people were living. And so figuring out, we were collaborating in an expansive way every minute we were there because we were walking through people's homes, essentially. You know, doors are open, and how do you engage someone in that respect? The other thing I was going to say about the comment earlier was to say in the traditional structure of a play, oftentimes the ending is based on recognition. And how can you – it becomes a real interesting thing to create a structure where you feel recognized without recognition. And in some ways, this is a flip of the usual recognition scene. The key character, the chorus who plays Penelope, doesn't recognize Odysseus, who's disguised. And Penelope, who lives at Luther Manor, doesn't recognize her daughter. But the audience and the whole point of the piece, the audience and the two characters, Odysseus and Mira, demonstrate that they recognize them. And then there's the bonding and connection through the final scene.
After working with the people at Luther Manor for a year on this, was it difficult to end this project and say essentially goodbye to the residents and staff you had been working with so intensely and hope that what you were doing would live on in some way?
It was. We had the cast party of all cast parties, first of all, at the Adult Day Center. It was just everyone was weeping and it was really –
singing and dancing.
It was fantastic. We didn't realize it, but we had all made gifts for each other and we gave T-shirts that had the chorus phrase, "Our cunning, noble, wise, and lovely queen" on them. And it was just a wonderful experience. And then it was a real leap of faith to kind of retreat. The actors had to go right away because we couldn't keep paying them to be in town. But the students kind of went out once in a while. I'd go out every once in a while. But we were really hoping that the facility would figure out the next steps for itself once this had taken hold and it had kind of institutional memory of this. And they have, I'm happy to report, especially Rusty, who you'll meet in the film, who is quite a character. And he plays 54 of the suitors. And he has started a radio show inside of Luther Manor, getting a whole television and radio studio donated. And they have KLM radio out there. No competition, don't worry. And they write their own original radio plays and perform them on the closed circuit.
And pardon the obvious nature of this question, but would you hope that a project like this spurs kind of a broader rethinking of what it means to care for people who are going through this sort of period in their life?
It's exactly what we hope. And we put together a little screening kit and an education guide, and we've been screening it around the country now. Actually, I just got back from Halifax. I screened it up there.
Which is not even in this country.
No, internationally, with the hope of really inspiring people to raise the bar on what you're offering as activities. Bingo's great, but do you learn through over time in it? Are you really doing something meaningful that's stretching people and helping people grow and allowing families to connect and staff to connect with residents, and that is inclusive, that doesn't stigmatize or leave out people with disabilities in a way that you can really say that we're creating community, that this is a place where we feel nourished?
Well, Anne Basting, Brad Lichtenstein, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Brad Lichtenstein is a documentary filmmaker and president of 371 Productions. Anne Basting is a playwright and professor of theater at UW-Milwaukee's Peck School of the Arts. The film Penelope will show at the Milwaukee Film Festival this afternoon and Wednesday afternoon. You'll find a link to more about it from wuwm.com/lakeeffect. Why the musical Ragtime resonates so strongly today. A chat with a director and an actor from the Milwaukee Reps production when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. More of Lake Effect now. I'm Mitch Teich. Government shutdowns and debt ceiling debates aside, attaining the American dream remains a goal for people of all political stripes in this country. It's been that way for decades, as the book and the play Ragtime makes evident. The musical is set in early 20th century America and follows the search for success undertaken by an Eastern European immigrant family, an African-American couple, and a well-off white family. The musical is currently being staged to large audiences at the Milwaukee Rep. Artistic director Mark Clements and actor Gavin Gregory joined Lake Effect's Bonnie North in the studio recently, and Clements talked about why the American dream remains an enduring theme.
You know, many of us, whether we know it or not, have an obsession and a fascination with it because it all means the American dream means something different to all of us. And there's an expectation that goes with that, to a degree, a certain element of entitlement as well. Because that's the way we're brought up, that if we work hard and that we live our lives well and that we will be rewarded. And so I think it's how people cut it up. You know, as an immigrant myself, that has a fair bit of resonance about when you're moving to this country as opposed to being just a visitor and living with all the kind of great things and warts and all, you know. So that's kind of been the theme of a lot of our work. You know, somebody pointed that out to me the other day, like, you really are obsessed with the American dream, aren't you? And I'm like, well, you know, that's our lives. We're living that every day. And so I'm interested in works whilst being entertaining and fun, you know, that can also, add a few layers of us to us as a decent human being, make us think a little bit, broaden our horizons, you know, so all of those things. And I think Ragtime, you know, if you kind of tick in the boxes, Ragtime probably ticks most of those, if not all of those boxes.
But it's based on the Doctorow book, which came out in the mid-70s.
I remember reading it when
it came out. And it's of a particular time in America when things kind of were breaking open. It was a huge wave of immigration from Eastern Europe. Mm-hmm. African Americans had been at least, you know, freed for a while, mm-hmm. even though there wasn't a lot of real justice yet, mm-hmm. as this play definitely shows, as the musical, rather. And yet there was this sense of unlimited possibilities. And I wonder if it's in some ways – I was thinking this as I was watching the show – if it's in some ways almost like a period piece because of that sense of unlimited possibility. I wonder if we all feel that way now, if that there is an unlimited possibility
here.
Well,
I think it's true. There is. And that's what keeps people hooked and why people still want to come to America and why there's, you know, an endless, you know, when you go through the green card immigration system, I mean, it's on the visa, you know, to come here, whether it's green card or some kind of visa. I mean, it's intense, the process, and it's become more so. People come here with huge expectation. They really do. They still do. You can see it in the faces and the things that people talk about. And, you know, when they arrive here, it's sometimes a different story or their paths are very different. But, you know, as the play shows, there are characters like J.P. Morgan and Houdini. And Houdini has this line and he says, think, you know, when you're getting down, I'm paraphrasing here, but think of Houdini, that magnificent immigrant, you know, who can break the chains of success. And, you know, using that as a metaphor that actually, and that's what we do, isn't it? I mean, it's the ethos of playing the lottery every week. I
right.
mean, you've got to be in to win. Only one person will win. The chances of it being you are, you know, you're going to have more chance of being eaten by a shark or hit by lightning. But there is somebody will win it. Somebody will pay a dollar and they will walk away with perhaps $240 million. It's kind of like the most obscene and extreme end of the American dream.
And so, Gavin, for you, you play Colehouse Walker, and he is a wonderful, wonderful character. And I want to say, is he based on Scott Joplin?
I probably loosely, you know what I mean? But I think looking back in history, there were many Cole Houses, you know what I mean? And I mean, here was a man that was, you know, self-educated, you know, was a hard worker, truly believed in the American dream, regardless of his skin color screaming out at people, especially at that time. And still held on to what the promise of America was supposed to be for everyone. And I think with his story, what I like about it is the fact that, yes, it is different than with what you saw with the immigrants coming in. This is a black man who didn't have the Ellis Island experience, but still believed that that dream is a possibility even for him. Even for how history says African Americans were treated until he didn't anymore.
I was going to say, I think till the very end he holds on to it. He has that optimism even in the face of everything.
I think that even with him becoming a quote unquote terrorist, if you will, he still was thinking that he was going to affect some sort of change. The way he went about it, you know, crazy, you know, because he went about it with rage. And I don't necessarily want to call it crazy. I mean, definitely, you know, there's a line in there with the loss of life and all of that is, you know, there's no excuse for it. But I think that in any revolution in any country, you know, there is serious collateral damage. And I think that that's how he was looking at it and still yet believing that he could affect change even in his rage, you know.
And still that dream was still out there for him to go to.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
The very final, you know, I mean, without giving the story away for those that don't know, you know, because there's some beautiful discoveries, but I mean, to the very end of the play, you know, I mean, when things are extremely difficult, nigh on impossible, I would say that he absolutely believes in the system, in that the system will be judicious and that he can trust in it.
Which is why
I put his faith in it.
Yeah, and that's what I think makes him so crazy, you know, with rage is just the fact that he cannot believe that the system is not working.
That
you know,
it's failing him.
Well, yeah, because he's done all the right things. He's educated. He, you know, he takes care of himself, the woman that he loves, his new family. He's trying to be upwardly mobile, and none of that mattered. he was reduced to a color. You know, and so
right.
I think it kind of, you know, there's also that whole balance that, you know, we constantly – raises its head through the news, you know, in different guises, but what it means to be patriotic and loyal, you know, and how much you're prepared to accept certain things with that ideal in mind. You know, I mean, I think, you know, criticizing a country, like you can criticize, you can love your family members, you know, but most of us love our family, but we are critical of them at times. It's natural. And actually, it's healthy to do that. You know, there's this ridiculous notion in this country, I think, more than anywhere where I've ever lived, where if you're patriot, if you are critical of certain aspects of governmental legislation, that is deemed to be unpatriotic. You know, I love living here. I'm raising my family here. You know, I'm not a citizen yet, but I'm eligible for citizenship, and I certainly can see myself moving in that direction. You know, I'm married to an American. I feel more American than I do British these days, you know, in terms of how I think and how I dream. And it's much more of an American model, and I'm very happy and proud to be here. Doesn't mean I cannot be critical of certain things that actually frighten me, you know, and scare me, especially having a young daughter growing, you know, who's grown up in this country. And I want to use my voice, you know, and I want to use it loud and clear. And I think this play constantly looks at that, how and what level, you know, is appropriate to do that. And when does it tip the balance? And, you know, the debate in the play between Colehouse Walker, who's obviously a fictitious character, but Booker T. Washington, who is one of the real characters in the play, that debate that they have in the play, it's one of my favorite scenes in the piece, you know, where the plight of the black man and how, you know, his evolution and how much, you know, does he have to assimilate himself to be accepted, you know, into society, and to what level is that appropriate, you know, I think is a really, there aren't any answers to that, and everybody has their own answer to it, maybe.
And it's also interesting, the idea of dissent, you know, and what that means in a healthy democracy.
Exactly. Yeah.
And what I love about this play is that you've got all kinds of levels of dissent in all these different characters.
Yep. So marital.
From the very small and the very personal to the very big and the very revolutionary, or the outwardly revolutionary, perhaps. Because everything's revolutionary.
And that's what's so brilliant about that book. You know, I mean, it's actually a really short novel, you know. And, you know, I hadn't actually read the novel before I knew I was going to do this piece.
Had you, Gavin?
No, actually, I hadn't either. I've done this – I've played this role before at another theater, but I did not read the novel until I did this particular production of it for Milwaukee.
I made them all read it.
Yeah, but you know, sometimes it doing your homework is it's a really good thing. Sometimes there are things that I feel like would probably hinder you as an actor. And at the time when I first did the piece, that's what I felt. I was like, oh, let me just find this. I got to know what it is. But to get a second crack at it and to delve into it a little more is just, you know, I think it informed what I'm doing on stage and informed the picture that he wanted to see as the director in a much better light.
Well, thank you both
for
coming in and telling a little bit of the story here for us and for the listeners. And we'll put all of the details on the website about where you can get tickets and all of the times and all of that kind of stuff. But I want to thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Gavin Gregory plays the role of Colehouse Walker in the Milwaukee Reps production of Ragtime, which runs through October 27th at the Quadracci Powerhouse Theater. Mark Clements directs and is artistic director of the Rep. They spoke with Bonnie North, and you can read much more about the production from a link at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. Children of the 80s and 90s Unite, a new book details what may have been a significant part of your childhood. We'll hear about the early history of the Nickelodeon Network when Lake Effect returns on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. People who were kids in the 1980s and 90s often have kids themselves now, and we, or they, find themselves talking about what might seem like ancient history, that once upon a time the idea of a TV network aimed expressly at kids was a new concept. It started with Nickelodeon, which created a common bond between kids from around the country, ranging from shows like Double Dare to Clarissa Explains It All to All That. Kids who grew up then still reminisce about those nuggets of entertainment. Matthew Klickstein was one of those kids partial to Salute Your Shorts and You Can't Do That on Television. As a grown-up, he interviewed the people who created Nickelodeon and who starred in the shows he grew up with, and the result is the new book Slimed, An Oral History of Nickelodeon's Golden Age. Klickstein spoke with Lake Effect's Eleanor Peterson about whether a book like this could even be possible 30 years from now.
Well, that depends on what you mean by possible in a book like this. You know, a lot of the people I talk to have been a party to the development of a lot of different cultural institutions. A lot of the people who helped to create Nickelodeon also helped to create MTV, for example, or other networks. We're really getting involved in the digital revolution that's been going on over the last few years. So many of them actually would tell me that what's funny about what you're doing right now, speaking to me, is, you know, you'll probably have the same there'll be someone doing this about some of the big YouTube shows that are on right now, say, or the golden age of YouTube or the golden age of Hulu or Netflix, maybe. So I think that there will always be oral histories. It's a tradition that goes back, you know, all the way to the beginning of man. I mean, the first stories ever told were oral, whether it was Homer or people we don't even know about. I actually, in preparing for the oral history aspect of this book, I actually read a book that was written, I believe, in the late 60s, if not 70s, called Edie, about Edie Sedgwick, that George Plimpton put together. So I think that there will always be oral histories. It's a genre I really enjoy. It makes it an easy read. You're really, I want to say hearing, but you're reading the story of whatever you're learning about from the people who actually made it. You don't have a biased opinion from the author. I really took myself out of this. And I'm a documentary filmmaker as well, which is why I don't really mind saying, yeah, I'm not necessarily the writer of this book as much as I am maybe an editor or curator, if you will. I feel very much like I edited together and produced a documentary in the making of this book. It just happens to be on paper rather than on the screen. So I think there will always be oral histories, for sure.
Is there a reason why you chose to do it in book format rather than a film documentary?
Actually, what's funny is it started off as a different kind of book originally. I am a huge fan of a creative nonfiction writer named Michael Azarad, who wrote a terrific Nirvana biography, and then another book that's one of my favorites of all time called Our Band Could Be Your Life, about the 80s music underground, about such bands as Sonic Youth and Minor Threat and whatnot. And I've read it multiple times, and it reads like Tom Wolfe, and I'm also a big fan of Tom Wolfe. And I just always thought that I would do something like Our Band Could Be Your Life, where every chapter is about a different band, but I would do that with something that I really was passionate about and that I really knew a lot about. And, you know, at one point I decided to do that with Nickelodeon. I happened to be reading a lot of Tom Wolfe at the time. So originally I was going to do it more of each chapter would be about different show, mm-hmm. and that I would actually write it, because I am a professional writer as well. I'm a journalist, and I've written a few other smaller books that were published by much smaller publishers. So I wanted originally to do it that way, but just with the trend of oral histories, the MTV oral history has just come out, and the accessibility of oral histories, that's kind of what it came down to. We actually at one point were in a bidding war with two different publishers, and the other one wanted it to be more of the Tom Wolfe version, but Penguin won out for multiple reasons. I'm glad that they did, and we decided to go with an oral history in that case, which was a very challenging but interesting process in itself.
Mm-hmm. And I like that because you got to hear directly from the people who were on the shows, and when I was reading it, one of the things that was a big thing to talk about in one of the chapters was the slime. And I didn't realize that you got paid more if you were slimed, and all the different backstories behind the slime about what it was made out of, how it was created. So what did the slime symbolize?
The slime was a really great semiotic for Nickelodeon itself, I feel. This symbol represented Nick starting in these humble beginnings with actual grime and grit. The actual slime, for anyone who doesn't know, and they probably don't until they read this book, was the very first time someone was slimed on You Can't Do That on Television, which is where it came from, was an actor named Tim Douglas. And they dumped leftover foodstuffs that had been sitting in a bucket for a week on him. So it was actual slime. And that kind of represented Nickelodeon at the time. It was kind of DIY, get what you can get together, do what you can, make it work, be innovative, push it, risk it, and go for it. And, you know, let's just all in this together, and you're going to get real slime poured on you. And then over the years, you know, they kind of bottled it up, if you will, and changed the recipe a few times. Obviously, they couldn't keep dumping, you know, rotten food on kids. You know, times changed. The network changed. And before you knew it, it's what it is today, which is it's quite literally vanilla pudding with some water and green dye. And now it's poured on the likes of Tom Cruise and Katy Perry and what have you. So I think that that is a really great metaphor for the way Nickelodeon changed over the years. And in fact, I believe it was Alan Goodman, who was one of the people who helped to rebrand Nickelodeon during its golden age and also worked a lot on MTV. He's the one who said, you know, what changed over the years is the slime got prettier, the slime got cleaner. You know, the adults got in charge of the slime. It wasn't this actual goopy, disgusting stuff that it was back in the day.
And with the branding, one of the things that was said in the book was that there really wasn't any branding. And for me, as a kid from back then, oh, I see the orange with the white lettering, and that's always Nickelodeon. It took different shapes and everything like that. And I'm kind of wondering, why did they go that route?
Alan Goodman and his partner Fred Seibert were the geniuses behind that, and they worked with a man named Scott Webb and a few others, Tom Pompicello, Tom Clack. But it was mainly Fred and Alan who devised this idea of making Nickelodeon a destination point. And they were also the ones who came up with the iconic logo for MTV, the original animation and riffs. That was Fred and Alan. So they really knew what they were doing. And they decided, rather than just bringing everyone in to watch these different shows, let's bring everyone in to watch Nickelodeon. And this was something that had been done in radio and magazines before. You're not reading a magazine necessarily for a specific author, a specific story, but because you understand that this magazine has a certain credence about it, you understand it's about a certain subject that you're interested in, and you're going to read it. And whatever stories are in there, you're going to hopefully enjoy. And so too with radio. This hadn't been done in television really before Fred and Alan got involved. And they decided to bring that mentality to television and make Nickelodeon something that you would watch whatever's on it because it's Nickelodeon, not necessarily just because of the specific shows on there. So the kind of branding that they brought on was, again, more of a destination point. It was something that you could come to. And what's really interesting about it, if you think about it, is a lot of the children's shows around that time were doing the same sort of thing where, you know, there were places. It was Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. It was Sesame Street. It was Pee-wee's Playhouse. Suddenly you had these places that you were going, these destination points. And that was something that Fred and Alan both helped to pioneer and were really tapping into, so that Nickelodeon was kind of a club. It was a clubhouse, if you will, to go to after school where you were understood, where you could just kind of rest and have fun. You weren't necessarily learning anything, which was kind of intentional. They didn't really want it to be educational. It was just for fun. And that's really what the early Nickelodeon during this time was all about.
Definitely. And I think it was interesting about how it's taking more of an MTV route rather than a Disney. And why didn't they want to go Disney?
For two reasons. One is they needed to delineate themselves from what Disney was already doing. It's important to note Disney Channel came out after Nickelodeon was launched. Nickelodeon was actually launched in 1979, but they didn't really get out there in the way that we know of them today until around 1983, 1984, which is around when Disney Channel came out. So the Nickelodeon came first. They were still competing very much directly with the Disney Channel for kind of the children's entertainment market. And what Nickelodeon decided to do, which was very smart, is rather than being a family network the way that Disney was, they decided to be a just straight-up kids network. They were narrow casting as opposed to broadcasting. It's just for kids. So doing, they made it much more scatological. They made the kids had a certain aesthetic about them that was much more, you know, hard and realistic as far as, you know, they were fat, they had pimples, they had greasy hair. They were not the blonde-haired, blue-eyed cherubs that we saw on the Disney Channel. So it was really a way to distinguish themselves. And also the people running Nickelodeon at the time were kind of like those people. Fred and Alan, you know, are goofballs, and they like throwing things at each other. And Jerry Laybourne, who was running the network at the time, you know, she'd smash your face into a pie. And, you know, they really were like that. So that was kind of more their sensibility anyway than the kind of squeaky, clean, antiseptic Disney Channel folks that was going on at that time.
So let's talk about some of those shows. Like Clarissa Explains It All. One thing I didn't realize, except I grew up in the Midwest, is that Clarissa was supposed to be set in the Midwest, but I didn't understand how What made it Midwestern?
I think just the average tone of it. You know, it was pretty clear that she was probably not in a big city. She spent a lot of time with her family. She spent a lot of time in her house, which also seemed rather Midwestern. It wasn't too big. It wasn't too small. You know, it wasn't an apartment in New York. Mm-hmm. It wasn't, you know, this, you know, big lavish house in the Hollywood Hills. It was just a typical, you know, little kind of duplex, if you will. And, you know, it was relatively modestly furnished. Melissa, or Clarissa, if you will, and Ferguson, her brother on the show, you know, dressed in a way that was rather average, even though Ferguson, you know, tried to be the conservative William Buckley type. But neither of them kind of spoke like streetwise kids. Again, not a really big city. And they just seem like wholesome, regular folks. So I think that that reads as Midwestern in itself.
And it's okay for them to have Sam climbing up the ladder into Clarissa's bedroom every once in a while, too.
Yeah, because you know what? They're not in some kind of crazy big city where, you know, some kind of, you know, child molester or whatever is going to come through. Leave your doors unlocked. Leave your windows open. That was sort of the mentality of that show. And so I think that that definitely read as Midwestern.
Another show that you focused on was Rugrats, and it was kind of more of a diverse show than compared to some of the other Nickelodeon shows because it featured single parents to married parents and African-American families and mixed-race families. And then there were different religions. And one of the stories that was focused on in here was that one character that caused some tension was Grandpa Boris, who was the Jewish father of Dee Dee and the grandfather of Tommy Pickles. And what was it about Grandpa Boris that caused such tension?
Well, it was both Grandpa Boris and Grandma Minka because they were from the old country, you know, straight out of Fiddler on the Roof. And they had, you know, the heavy Russian accent. And they looked like as Michael Bell, who was the voice of Grandpa, along with some of the other characters on the show, said they looked like, you know, potatoes. But what the irony is that though the Anti-Defamation League came in and said, hey, these look like caricatures that would be done by people like Hitler, you know, making fun of Jews and making them look like potatoes, I guess, if you will. The irony is most of the people on Rugrats were Jewish, from the writers to the producers to one of the creators, Paul Germain, I believe, was Jewish. And, you know, certainly Melanie Chardoff, who was the voice of Grandma Minka, as well as Mom Dee Dee on the show, and Michael Bell, pretty sure, was Jewish as well. In fact, I know that he was because he talked about his grandpa looked like an old potato. you know, basically, Michael and Melanie were doing their grandparents, or doing their parents. And they did it so well that there were groups that thought that they were being racist against Jews. However, as it says in the book, the real victory came out in that when they showed the episode at various synagogues and whatnot, I believe on Passover, people were cheering, people were excited, people were glad to see this. And, you know, I think that that's really important.
Matthew Klickstein, thank you so much for being on Lake Effect.
Thank you, Eleanor.
Lake Effect's Eleanor Peterson spoke with author Matthew Klickstein on his book, Slimed, An Oral History of Nickelodeon's Golden Age. The book was just released late last month. That's Monday's edition of Lake Effect. Tomorrow on the show, a writer returns to UWM to learn why so many African-American students struggle and often fail to graduate, and will deconstruct the mystique surrounding one tricky section of the ACT. I'm Mitch Teich. Fantastic to have you along for the ride today, and I sure hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. It's 11 o'clock. Stay tuned. Fresh air is next.